I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. When Ernest and Joseph Gallo died in 2007, decades after their brother Julio, it put an end to a family saga that had stretched for the better part of a century. But the company the brothers founded is still going strong. To this day, it remains a very private business run by three generations of Gallos. And it's still the largest family-owned winery in the world today. A lot has changed in the wine industry since the Gallos first landed in Modesto. Not only the public's tastes, but also the impact of climate change, especially in the wine regions of California like Napa and Sonoma. On the show this week is Cyril Penn. He's the editor-in-chief of Wine Business Monthly, a trade magazine for the wine industry. We'll talk about the current state of the Gallo family wine brand and how it fits within the larger wine industry. Plus, we'll get into how California wildfires are affecting wine production. At the end, we'll be bringing in Barbara Bogave, who wrote this series, for a quick chat about how she researched this story. All that's coming up next.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts. Cyril Penn is editor-in-chief of Wine Business Monthly. Cyril, welcome to Business Wars.
Oh, nice to be here.
What does Gallo mean in the world of wine today? I think everyone has heard the brand name, certainly everyone listening. But how does the brand fit into the larger wine industry?
Oh, in myriad ways. They're the leading family wine company in the world, really. They're the largest U.S. wine company. They have their fingers in a little bit of everything. The wine industry is very fragmented compared to other industries, with lots and lots of players, some big ones and lots of small ones, 10,000 wineries in the United States. But they're in little bit of everything. They represent, I don't know, 20, 25% of all wine sold in the United States.
That's incredible. But I'm wondering what that means both to the everyday wine drinker and to people in the wine business. I mean, you know, there's certain brands have certain, well, different kinds of cachet associated with them. When you think of the name Gallo, well, it's certainly evolved over the years. I think it's safe to say, but how would you characterize what the brand name Gallo means to the everyday wine drinker and to people in the wine business?
Well, I mean, Gallo is you know, besides Mondavi, probably the biggest brand that people think of in wine. And it's evolved over the years, obviously, from a perception of being more everyday cheap jug wines, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, to the position they're at today, where the Gallo brand extends kind of across all price points and quality levels. The Gallo Wine Company has so many brands besides the actual Gallo brand itself. They have wines in every price point and every style from most wine-producing countries around the world, actually.
Having said that, I've heard Gallo described as a supermarket wine probably most frequently. Is that a description Gallo's trying to shake off or no?
Well, I mean, I think no. I mean, I you go in the supermarket and there will be brands from Gallo that you don't even realize are Gallo brands. They dominate the supermarket shelves, and then they're the category captains at retail. So,
Gina Gallo, Julio's granddaughter, runs Gallo Family Vineyard Sonoma Reserve, which seems to be aimed at a more, would you say, high-end wine market? I'm just trying to sort of put them on a graph here somehow.
Oh, boy. What would the price point be? You know, $20, $30 on up. Super premium, you could call it. Absolutely. And, you know, the Gallos have been in Sonoma, actually, since the early 70s. But their holdings in coastal regions have just gone up and up and up, and they continue to expand and acquire properties that are more premium.
You know, as big as Gallo is, and as much of the market that it has and the marketplace that it's in, you have a company that is incredibly secretive. I mean, they keep company information very close to the vest. What have you heard, or what do you understand to be the reason or rationale for that? And does it stand out as unusual in the wine industry?
Well, yes, it stands out as unusual in the wine industry because the wine industry is the most open industry I've ever covered as a journalist, and I've covered computers and biotech and, you know, the energy industry and on and on. And in the wine industry, people want to talk to you and they want to share their stories and they want to help one another. There's a sense that a rising tide floats all boats. And I don't know what the how things originally came together many years ago in terms of Gallo being secretive and not wanting to talk. But sometimes when you when you're the leader, you have a target on your back. And I think this goes way back into, you know, the early 70s when there were, the UFW was boycotting Gallo, you know, and organizing and all of that kind of stuff. So that way of doing business goes back to Ernest and Julio a long way. It's kind of in the company's DNA.
Yeah. Even back to their parents, when you get right down to it, there's so much intrigue. We've been exploring that a bit on the Business Wars program. I mean, there was a sort of a family prohibition against talking about their parents because, you know, of how they died and that sort of thing.
Sure. And then there was the whole lawsuit with the brother. There's a book called Blood and Wine. They've opened up a little bit over the years. I mean, but they've always had that reputation. Their spokesman for many, many years was a guy named Dan Solomon. He's retired now. He lives in town. I know him. And he used to introduce himself as Dan No Comment Solomon.
Hey, as a journalist, and you talked about how you've covered different industries, why did you get into reporting on wine? What was it about this industry that sort of attracted you after covering the many industries that you've been involved with?
I was recruited. I got a call. I was covering the energy industry at the time, and I was asked, "Hey, do you want to come do this?" And I said, "Yeah. Well, I'll think about it. You know, let me check it out." And I honestly wasn't sure at first. I thought, "Oh, that's not hard hitting investigative journalism or anything like that. You know, it's wine. But boy, it's been a lot of fun because the wine business has so many layers and different aspects to it. I mean, it's agriculture, it's sales, it's marketing, it's, you know, you name it, technology. It's involved in wine, and the people are great.
Do you see any parallels with other industries that you've covered? I mean, you mentioned the energy industry, for example.
Well, I think we were just talking about how the wine business is, people are more open. They all want to share their stories. You know, covering other industries, people, when they talk to journalists, they want to talk about their position. They usually have an agenda, or they don't want to talk to you. They don't want to give away their secrets or whatnot. In the wine industry, people want to share because they want to help each other. There's a real sense of camaraderie, and it's about hospitality.
But not so much with Gallo, it sounds like.
Well, I think that this is just the company culture that goes a long way back, but they've opened up quite a bit from the way it used to be. I mean, I could tell you stories. One time I wanted to do a story about a bottling line they installed, and the reporter that was on staff with us, he had actually sold them the bottling line in a previous job, and they still didn't want to talk about it. So it can be kind of, you know, I have story after story of, you know, asking them, "Hey, can we do a story about such and such?" And they usually will say, well, maybe. And then it takes about a month for them to slowly say, "Nah, we're not interested in talking to you." But to their credit, they really have opened up. Gallo's run by the third generation now, and they're a lot more, they're out there in the industry. We just reported about a research seminar that was held last week where one of their senior scientists was attended and was very open about discussing her research. So,
I guess one of the things that makes it possible for Gallo to play it so close to the vest, though, is the fact that this is a company that's vertically integrated, right? I mean, Gallo in 58 opened the Gallo Glass Company. They're making their own wine bottles. How big is something like that a part of their business, do you think?
Well, I mean, that's a major piece of business. I don't know how what the capacity of that plant is off the top of my head, but I want to say they, at one point, were making almost 30% of the wine glass.
Gee whiz.
It's not small. But they also have a division called G3 that has seven divisions within that company that sells other things business to business in the wine business. So you've got corks, they sell capsules, they sell equipment for bottling lines. They're in logistics, so they ship grapes to other wineries at crush time. About 30% of all of the grapes shipped in California are shipped by Gallo.
When you consider all of these, I don't want to call them tentacles because that sounds a bit like a put down, but on the other hand, this is an enormous company. I'm wondering, can you think of any other company in the wine business that has its hooks in so many other parts of the wine business? Is there anything to compare to Gallo in the wine industry? It doesn't sound like in the U.S., but anything globally?
Well, I would say no in terms of the vertical integration, and they really have a long-term view of things. There are other companies that are close competitors. Well, maybe not even close. Distant second, third, fourth competitors. Like, let's say Gallo's doing 80 million cases a year of sales. And there's other companies doing 50 and 40 and 30 and 20 like that right behind.
Wow.
But they're out in front by quite a ways. And they're about to get bigger because they're about to close on a very large merger with Constellation Brands, where they're acquiring 30 brands and five major winemaking facilities. And that deal's been in the works since last April, but it's supposed to close next month.
When you're a company as big as Gallo, I mean, I suppose you could say, what's the point in getting bigger? Of course, there's always going to be greater market share, more money. Who's going to say no to that? But also, there's this notion that you can become top-heavy, too. And that can slow innovation. It can make you vulnerable to being blindsided by those companies that are more nimble, that sort of thing. What is the advantage to being positioned as Gallo is? And do you see an endpoint here, or is it just about growth, 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 as far as you can tell?
Well, their growth is about long-term growth. They're a private company. The wine business is very much a long-term business because of the nature of the business. You know, the production cycle takes 3, 4, 5 years just to get your first cash flow when you start a business, right? You've got 3 years to plant the grapes, another year to process it, finish it, getting out to market, and boom, 5 years before you have any payback whatsoever. A lot of companies in the wine business think more, most companies think long-term, but some of the bigger ones, like their second distant competitor, which would be Constellation Brands, although that's a big company because they're involved in spirits and beer, they own Corona, stuff like that.
Sure.
But those are companies, if you're a publicly traded company, you have pressure from shareholders to have short-term profit. That is not really consistent with the wine business because the wine business is a long-term business. For example, in this acquisition that Gallo's about to make, they're going to acquire a lot of production capacity that they probably don't need yet, but they're thinking long term.
Thinking long term means that they need to add to that production capacity because they see continued growth dependent on taking advantage of prices where they are today, not where they are tomorrow, clearly. But as you think about, like, say, what trends are happening in wine today, you've got to look at the here and now, and you've also got to figure, well, what's this going to look like 5, 6, 7 years from now? What do you see as the biggest trends happening in wine today, and how does Gallo fit into those?
Gallo really feels a responsibility to bring new wine drinkers in to wine. I mean, there are a lot of people that drink alcoholic beverages that don't necessarily drink wine, and there are a lot of younger people that don't necessarily drink wine. So Gallo offers products that you could call them entry level, if you will. You could call them innovative. That are aimed toward new wine consumers, and at the same time, you know, they're selling wine, you know, for collectors at the very high end as well. So it runs the gamut. But I think they're very much focused on growing the category.
You know, when I think about wine and wine in the United States in a sort of a larger sense beyond California, but certainly California as well, there's a lot of tourism that's wrapped up with this industry too, and part of that is the expansion trying to grow their own markets, but also sort of trying to diversify a bit. Does Gallo play in that field at all?
Absolutely. They have, I don't know how many wineries, 20-something wineries, and many of these wineries operate as separate entities, and it's all about the hospitality. You mentioned supermarkets. Yes, they have major distribution across the country and in large chain stores and you know, supermarkets and all of that, but they also sell directly to consumers who come to their properties and have an intimate experience with the winery. They're very much into that. And especially now, what's happening in the world with COVID and all of that, people are buying directly from wineries, from their homes, online.
Speaking of current events, I know California sustained some fire damage, some very devastating fire damage this year. Could you provide something of an overview of the extent of damage in the wine region there, Napa, Sonoma?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, in terms of acres in California, almost 4 million acres burned. In terms of acres where in wine regions in California, it's almost 3 million acres. I mean, it's considerable. In Napa, it was considerable. I ran a story today that outlines about 10 different fires and what their effects were. The smoke from the fires may affect the wines, and we won't know the extent of that for some time. It has to do with the chemistry of wine, but some of that potential smoke impact, you know, may not be noticeable for a few months. The industry's dealing with that. And it was also difficult, you know, obviously having fires after COVID, right? We shut down tasting rooms in California, and they were just starting to open up, and they were open to tasting outside, right? Because we all have outdoor spaces. So that was doing fairly well. And then boom, we have these fires, and we had, boy, 3 or 4 weeks of smoke in my neighborhood.
This obviously will have a huge impact on some of the smaller wineries. Does it have much, does it make much of a mark on a company as large as Gallo, do you believe?
Yes and no. I mean, it affects everybody, obviously. With Gallo, they're so big in supermarket distribution that they're doing better and better. Their sales, I'm sure, are way up this year because people are buying at retail. There was a lot of pantry loading that went on when the lockdown started, and people were buying lots and lots of wine. So a lot of the tried and trusted brands that Gallo owns are the kind of brands that consumers are gravitating towards right now. Some of the large wine companies are doing very well. I mean, sales, if you look in Nielsen track channels, are up something like 15-20% year on year every week when we look at the numbers. Whereas small wineries that depend on tasting room sales and wine clubs, their visitation is way down.
I want to go back to something you were talking about just a few minutes ago. You were talking about how the smoke being a devastating issue, one that we may not know the dimensions of for some time. Why is that such a devastating issue? Does this have to do with the chemistry of grape growing? Does it of the way that wineries operate? Or could you say a little more about that?
So wineries haven't had to deal with the effects of smoke from wildfires in the past in the United States very much. There have been some fire events, more so in Australia. They've had to deal with it in their wine industry there. The smoke taint that can occur is very difficult to get rid of. Sometimes it can be gotten rid of through various means. There's something called spinning cone. There's microfiltration. There's things that you can do, but nothing's perfect. So a lot of wine, if it can't be fixed, will be declassified or destroyed this year. And we don't know how much of that will happen. Wineries are not going to sell bad wine to consumers. They just won't do it. Consumers are not going to. This is not going to be a consumer problem. It's an industry problem.
Very interesting. They're not going to pass that along, try to slip it under.
No, nobody's going to put their brand at risk.
Yeah. Interesting dynamic here. I understand that perhaps because in rosé, they don't use the skins. What, you'd have more perhaps rosé next year, something along those lines?
With the red wines, you know, you're leaving the wine on the skins to get that extraction. And you're right, there will be probably a lot of rosé made in 2020.
So maybe time to stock up if the laws of supply and demand stay in shape. Be a whole lot more rosé.
Probably be available at reasonable prices.
Yeah. What are you hearing from other winemakers worried about focusing on post-wildfires? Are we looking at a sort of new normal, what with climate change and everything? Or what is the feeling in the business right now?
I think that's a discussion that we haven't had yet, but that people are talking about that we're going to have. I mean, there's so many layers of complexity, right, to dealing with climate change and managing forests and managing this, if it is a new normal going forward, which I hope it's not, but it certainly could be, right? So that discussion's happening. There's a smoke exposure task force that was put together a couple of years ago after there were some fires, and that has gotten some research money, and winemakers are talking quite a bit. They're comparing notes. I was at a winery yesterday that is experimenting using an ozone treatment that's been used to treat fruits and vegetables to get the ash off of grapes before they're vinified. That may be promising. There are lots of little tricks and techniques that people are trying, and they're spending a lot of time talking to one another, sharing information, trying to solve things.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind.
I'm old enough, I'm afraid, to remember when the idea of getting a California wine seemed both vaguely exotic and vaguely down market. You know, the idea was that, you know, any wine from the United States couldn't be as good as the stuff that you might get from Europe. So, I mean, and I'm curious, where does California now stand? I would think that right there, head and shoulders with the international giants, right? I mean,
well, you probably heard about the Judgment of Paris that happened in the early 1970s, and that was a watershed moment because there was a reporter there. It was a blind tasting where California did very well versus the French, and there were French judges that liked the California wines as well or better than their own wines, and they were very yeah. upset to learn that they'd been tasting California wines. I mean, that's already 40 years ago, but we've certainly come a long way in terms of the recognition that California can make world-class wine. That said, there's great wines made all around the world.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So if you were to say to some of your colleagues overseas, perhaps, talking about exciting new products coming out of California, does anything stand out to you or just more of the good stuff?
Well, lots of things stand out. There's less tradition in California, whereas obviously there's more history in Europe, for example. So they have had a large head start on us in terms of learning what grows well where and how to make it and how to make it right and make it well. And they have a lot of regulations around that and tradition around that. And here we're still figuring out which varietals grow best in which regions, and we figured a lot of it out, but there's still things that we learn, which is fun.
A lot more room for growth and a lot more room for change. And Cyril Penn is tracking with it. Of course, you can check out Cyril's work over at winebusiness.com/WBM. That's winebusiness.com/WBM. Cyril Penn, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on Business Wars. It's been a real pleasure.
Pleasure being with you, David. Thank you.
Before we close the book on The Gallows for Good, I want to welcome to the show Barbara Bogave. She researched and wrote this series. Barbara, welcome to this side of the mic on Business Wars.
Hi, David. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Good to talk with you, too. And for those listeners who may not know, Barbara is something of a fixture on the public radio scene in the Los Angeles area and beyond, way beyond. Barbara, it's good to reconnect. We wanted to close out this series with you because you had the difficult job of digging into the story of The Gallows. This is a family famously media shy and secretive about its backstory. So first off, how did you come to be interested in this story to begin with?
Oh, you know, honestly, it was one of those internet rabbit holes. I was looking up, and you might have seen this video on YouTube. Most people know it. The Orson Welles outtakes of his commercials.
Oh, yeah, the infamous outtakes.
Right. And that, you know, I was listening to those, and then that led me to some old Gallo ads for Ripple and one for Thunderbird that I'd never seen from the 70s that was kind of in jive, very disco. Uh-huh. And yeah, from there, I just went down into the bowels of the internet, and I discovered this story about the family dynasty and the murder-suicide and just things I never knew about the company.
It's tough to get that image of Orson Welles out of your head once it's been introduced, because that is truly epic to see him going. Looked like he had partaken just a wee bit before the cameras started
far
rolling.
More than a wee bit.
Yeah. Trying to be charitable, Barbara. So tell us a little bit about the Gallo Company position on the events that were covered in the story. How cooperative were they as you tried to piece all of this together?
The official company position is that the company was started by these two brothers, Ernest and Julio, in 1933, and they used their personal savings and a loan from a family member to start this company. And their brother, Joseph, their younger brother, had nothing to do with it. And as far as the lawsuit's concerned, they put out a statement at the time that said, his charges were ridiculous, Joseph Gallo had obviously brought his countersuit in an effort to coerce the winery to drop the trademark infringement suit. So, you know, so they took that position and then they don't comment on it. So this series is based on interviews. Actually, it's an oral history project on the part of UC Berkeley. There's an oral history series of them on Gallo. And so it was people who worked for the company at the time. That's really interesting. And also Ernest Gallo was interviewed for that too. And
wow.
His transcript was sealed until after his death. And then there are two major books about Gallo and this whole history. And the main one is by Ellen Hawks, and it's called Blood and Wine. And it's just a fascinating, unauthorized history of the Gallo Company.
You know, I think one of the darkest aspects of this, and you were just referring to the 1974 or so lawsuit involving trademark infringement and one of the Gallo brothers, but it's the deaths of their father and mother that I think it adds a macabre element to this story, to say the very least. How did you get your information on that?
First of all, I just want to correct you. It was in the 1980s, the trademark.
1980s. Okay,
yeah.
My bad.
Which is a long time ago still. You know, it's the whole series covers more close to 90 years. So it's a little hard to say what the Gallo Company's official position on this is, because there are so many parts to this story. And of course, as you say, a big part of it is the murder-suicide or alleged murder-suicide of the patriarch and his wife of the Gallo family, Joseph Gallo, or Giuseppe Gallo. That was his Italian given name.
And so you got a lot of that from newspaper articles that were written at the time?
Yes, it was covered in the news. And then there are various accounts of it that have been told by Joseph Gallo, the youngest brother, and then by Ernest and Julio. And I should say that Ernest and Julio put out their own as told to official autobiography called Ernest and Julio Gallo, Our Story. And that was kind of damage control for that whole trademark infringement issue, where they kind of put their line out on what happened on their side of the story. Mm-hmm. And the brothers all have very different memories of that time and very different ideas about what happened to their parents. And then, of course, there was gossip on the part of many people in the area. And that's referred to in both news stories and also in the deep dive research that these authors have done on the Gallo family.
One of the things that Cyril Penn, editor-in-chief of Wine Business Monthly, told us was just how secretive the Gallo family was and is to this day about the company. And I'm wondering how much pushback you got as you were working on this story, or what obstacles you had to overcome as you tried to recreate some of the events here.
Well, since the company doesn't comment on these long ago events, it wasn't so much a pushback as these things will never be known. I mean, all of the principals have died that were involved in this story. There are eyewitness accounts, though, and then there are the conflicting stories that the brothers tell. And that was the hard part of this story. How do you balance the conflicting memories and what makes the most sense? So I would say that was the challenge.
One of the more touching aspects of this story, I suppose you could say, was the relationship between Joseph and Giulio, because Joseph sort of felt like he remained connected as long as Giulio was loyal to him. And my sense of it was, based on the reporting that you did, he felt ultimately betrayed by what happened to him in the 80s, no?
Yes, definitely. I think his family members would say that his heart was broken. And, you know, this was a very tight family up until that point, even despite all of the, I guess, the difficult things they had gone through. And Joseph had maintained relationships with his brothers. They had Sunday dinners. But all along, you're right, he was much closer to his brother, Giulio. And Giulio just had a reputation for being a much warmer person. Ernest was a very demanding, very critical, and could really excel at humiliating people, including his brothers and his sons.
For people who want to learn more about the Gallos, anything interesting you learned that didn't make it into the story? You know, the cutting room floor stuff, as we say?
As far as the business is concerned, I mean, it's a fascinating story, the wartime part of this, which we told in part, but
right.
But a big part of it involved what happened during the war with distilleries and the liquor industry, and they're trying to take over the California wine industry. So that's a really fascinating story if people are into spirits and the history of alcohol in America. I would definitely recommend they look that up.
Along the way, I know you gathered a lot of tchotchkes and other bits of memorabilia related to the Gallos. I'm wondering if people wanted to find out more, other than just doing a raw dive online, is there any place that you would recommend that they begin or perhaps continue with this exploration of the Gallo story?
I would refer them first to this book, Blood and Wine, by Ellen Hawks. But I found most interesting, I think, the oral histories of the Gallo company, which are part of the UC Berkeley's digital archives. You just hear from all sorts of people who worked for the company and, you know, on every level. And it's such an insight into that post-prohibition era and how a company starts from the ground up. I mean, this was before they hardly had anyone keeping the books, really. You know, that's the kind of information you're getting from people who are right on the ground floor. And I bet your listeners would be interested in that.
Barbara Bogave researched and wrote this series on the Gallos. Barbara, it's been great to say hello to you again. Thanks so much for taking time to do this, and thanks so much for a terrific series. It was really fascinating.
Oh, thank you. And it's so lovely to chat again, David. Take care.
From Wondery, you've been listening to Episode 7 of Gallo, Godfathers of Wine for Business Wars. Hey, if you like our show, please give us a 5-star rating and a review, and be sure to tell your friends. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. And to listen to episodes 1 week early, join Wondery Plus. You'll also find some links and offers from our sponsors in the episode notes. And supporting them helps us keep offering our shows for free. There's another way you can support the show, and that's by filling out a small survey at wondery.com/survey. And don't forget to tell us which business stories you'd like to hear. I'm your host, David Brown. Michelle Lanz produced this episode. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Emily Frost. Sound designed by Kyle Randall. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer, Beckman, and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.